Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Community in Depth, and we are thrilled to have in studio today Mr. Spencer Johnson. He's a retired teacher, and he's a historian, and we are going to get a history lesson about the 4th of July. Great to see you.
Thank you.
You are all dressed up, and I love that. We're going to post a picture on our Facebook page because people come to our space dressed up, but not in costume like you.
Yeah. Well, it's the 4th of July, and I do have a full uniform for the American Revolution I used to use in school quite a bit, and also some other demonstrations. I didn't wear all of it today, but, you know, it just kind of puts you in the mood.
So you're wearing the
tricorn.
Tricorn hat.
Yeah.
And what is the history of that, please?
Well, it was just a fashionable hat from the time. Civilians wore, you know, three-cornered hats, tricorn hats. Military did. In the military, the front piece is over my left eye. If you were a civilian, it'd be straight.
Oh.
But that's so when you hold your musket up at shoulder arms on your right shoulder, the hat doesn't get in the way. Oh. So it's sometimes called a cocked hat because it's twisted off to the side.
They look really heavy and kind of hot.
It's a fur felt hat, like beaver felt. It's a warm hat, but very fashionable.
Oh, very.
Well, I mean, if that's.
You're not telling me anything I don't see.
Yeah.
Okay. So that is the hat of the day. And the uniforms for the Revolutionary Army, weren't they all kind of ragtag?
Well, it's a little bit of everything. That's a really good point. First of all, let's talk about the British. And the British were the redcoats. And they were red for a long time. And even with all the hoopla in Britain today, you see British redcoats. It's just that's been their tradition.
Okay.
The Americans weren't always blue. The coat that I have is a blue woolen coat with red facings, which means the collars, the cuffs, you know, and the front lapels are blue. But they would be red. In the American Revolution, there were lots of colors. Probably the most common color was brown. For some reason, the paintings showed a lot of blue, so we stuck with that. The color on the facings, the trim, would tell you what regiment you're in. The buttons on your coat would have a number, and a good officer could sit, like George Washington sitting on a hill, could look down and say, well, there's the 17th Pennsylvania, because you could see their blue uniforms, but they've got other colors. Just like you can, you know, if you're surfing channels on TV and you see a football game, you know exactly who's playing within a second, because you recognize that. But you're right, because we really weren't a country at the very beginning, there was a shortage of supplies. So George Washington's, you know, men, after the Battle of Lexington, Concord, and then Bunker Hill, when he starts to organize his army, they didn't have enough uniforms. So a lot of people just showed up in whatever clothes that they had. He was getting a lot of good hunters from the western part of Pennsylvania, you know, that like where Pittsburgh is today, and they were wearing something that's called a hunting shirt, sort of a Lindsay Woolsey wrap with a cape and a lot of fringe on it, and that was just a common shirt. And the British very quickly realized that the men in those shirts are really good shots. Like most muskets, they'll shoot a great distance, but you can't reliably hit a target past, you know, 50 to 100 yards. But riflemen could hit something at about 300 yards if they practice. So George Washington was smart enough to realize that the British know there's a reputation for this jacket, this hunting shirt. And so he started having those made for some of his men just to intimidate the British. Eventually, there's an alliance with France. And France, I don't know that they were so much excited about our liberty, this is before their revolution, as they just wanted to stick it to their old enemy, England. So they were secretly giving us supplies with Ben Franklin's negotiation. Eventually, they'd do it openly, and they'd start sending blue coats. But there weren't enough for everybody, so there was a lottery. If you were in a company of men, and everybody put a little number in a hat and draw it out, and if you got the right number, you got the coat. And then you'd be put in the front rank before, so you looked really good.
So what year did the Revolutionary War actually start, and how many people were living in was it just the 13 colonies, basically?
Yeah, well, it's kind of complicated, and I'll go through it. First of all, people, you know, debate. Well, the Battle of Lexington was in April of 1775, Lexington and Concord, and that's where the shot heard around the world, and the first conflicts. People sometimes say, well, but didn't it start with the Boston Massacre? Or there's lots of other things. Nothing ever happens in a vacuum. Everything always is a buildup. So things have been building up for a while. Part of it was the French and Indian War, and in that war, England and the American colonists fought the French and Indians. And that's where George Washington and Paul Revere and everybody else were British soldiers. We were British citizens. And that was, you know, 10, 12 years before the American Revolution, but there was a huge debt, and Britain wanted to collect on that debt. So they started changing their tax systems. The biggest issue we had is that we didn't get to vote. It's not the fact that we pay taxes, that we were not really represented, didn't get to vote. So a lot of times in April of 1775 is when the first shots were fired. It was just sort of a mob thing that was going on at that time. And then soon after that, the Battle of Bunker Hill, which the Americans lost, by the way. It's just that the British took heavy, heavy casualties. And since we're talking about the 4th of July, this is when we declared our independence. You know, Thomas Jefferson, there was a committee, the Second Continental Congress. We weren't a country yet. We were, in fact, when we first started the Revolutionary War, we weren't necessarily fighting for independence. We were just fighting to get King George to pay attention to us, to listen, and, you know, maybe to convince Parliament that we should be able to vote or to lessen the taxes.
Because England was governing the colonies at that point.
Yeah, and we were 13 colonies, and there were also British colonies up in Canada. It had been French until the French and Indian War. There were Spanish, Florida, and a lot of the Southwest was Louisiana, all the way through Mexico was Spanish. So there were Europeans living all over the place. But the 13 colonies that we have, you know, that's what we considered it. Part of the difference between Massachusetts and when you get up into Canada, where Maine is today, was kind of a big wilderness. So that was not really considered much of anything. So maybe that's why it divided. You know, and after the American Revolution, there were a lot of people still loyal to the king that just moved up to Canada because they, you know, they had been loyal citizens and they didn't want the independence. They wanted to stay loyal. Some went back to Britain and some went up to Canada. Anyway, with the 4th of July, Congress said, well, maybe we need to say something about what we're doing. Let's make a statement. And so they formed a committee, and there were five people in that committee. Thomas Jefferson was one of the people, and he wrote most of the Declaration. There were other people, too, but he was the main author of that. And the reason we celebrate the 4th is because that's when it was declared. Some things say that it maybe wasn't signed completely till a little bit later on to get Congress all in the same place. But that's when we declared the independence on the 4th of July.
But it wasn't necessarily when we got our independence.
Oh, my gosh, no. So the war was long. So the American Revolution goes until 1781 or 1783, depending on how you want to define it, okay? Because the last battles were fought, but then there were still negotiations going on, you know, to sign the treaty. It was called the Treaty of Paris. But yeah, there was a long and a bloody war. And a lot of times we weren't doing really well. George Washington, his biggest skill, and there's a really good book called 1776. It's just about the year 1776. His biggest skill right then is not winning, but just not losing, figuring out how to save that army and keep it together. There was a lot of politics, a lot of backstabbing with generals and politicians and things like that.
Well, that's nothing new.
No, exactly. And it's complicated. It's not a simple thing. It's very complicated. But finally in 1781, at the Battle of Yorktown, there was a little bit of fighting after that, and that's in Virginia. That's when Lord Cornwallis surrenders and pretty much was kind of, you know, the beginning of the end. Now, keep in mind, too, that when they signed the Declaration, Ben Franklin was involved in this, and he said something to the effect of, now we must all hang together or most assuredly we'll hang separately. Keeping in mind that we always talk about ourselves as patriots, and I believe that, but you know, it's all perspective. We were the insurgents. We were the rebels, the rabble-rousers fighting against our own country. And we felt like we had a good reason to do that because we didn't feel like the British government was representing us properly. But if we had lost, all the people who signed the Declaration would have been hung as traitors. But they weren't. And then John Hancock, he was the president of the Second Continental Congress, not of the United States because it didn't exist. But he's the one that signed it the largest. And then he said, I guess King George can read this now without his spectacles. So he signed it really big. And that's why we use the phrase of John Hancock for his signature today.
Exactly. So I think a lot of people think our country was, quote unquote, started, you know, with George Washington being a first president in 1776. But he actually didn't become president till 1789.
Yeah. So here's what happened with that. And he didn't sign the Declaration because he wasn't there. He was fighting.
He was fighting.
He was fighting. And there were other leaders that were there and that were really, really important. After we win, we come up with a government called the Articles of Confederation. And it was purposely made into a weak government. It didn't want to have a lot of strengths because we had already had sort of a really, you know, strong and firm government with Britain. And we felt the people that wrote our government thought, well, we don't want all that. We want something that's a little bit easier to work with and not so many rules. I'm oversimplifying it, but that's what it was. The problem with the Articles of Confederation was too weak. There weren't certain powers that were put in there. You know, like if there was a problem again, there was no power to raise an army. There was no power to tax people, to raise money.
And why was that done?
Because Britain, we felt that Britain was overbearing and we didn't want to have another overbearing government. And we're going to get into the politics of the parties here in just a second, I hope. But, you know, there was a lot of problems with it. And so finally, in 1786, there were people saying, well, we need to get together and kind of rewrite this thing. And some of them, this is, you know, in 1787, back again in Philadelphia, in Independence Hall, that's where the Declaration was signed. They had another convention for the Constitution, and what they end up doing, and this is kind of sneaky, again, politics, is they kind of like, okay, we're going to close the doors and lock the windows and not tell anybody what we're doing, and we're going to just throw the articles out and come up with something totally different, not totally different, but, you know, and it's going to have a lot more firmer for details in there. And they spent all summer working on that one, and George Washington was involved in that one too, and they came up with the Constitution. So, you know, the Declaration is not really, it's just saying why we're fighting. And we're going to be independent. The Articles of Confederation was our government, but the Constitution is the government that we have today. So when you go to Washington, go to the National Archives, you can see the original Declaration and the original Constitution, and that's a 5-page document, you know, in the National Archives. It would be really hard to steal it like it in the movie. That's a little kind of extreme. But it's always fun when you take students there and say, oh, you remember seeing that movie about that. And so then George Washington was elected. I don't know. I'd have to look to see if he ran against anybody, but he was elected president, and John Adams was his vice president. And then the second time there was an election, everybody loved George Washington. We'll elect George Washington again. We did not have a rule about a two-term limit. But after two terms, people wanted George Washington again. He said, no, I'm not going to do this. I'm stepping down. We did not have this revolution and create a new government so that we can have the same person. They might end up having too much power. We have a two-term limit. Well, he did that informally. And it wasn't until Franklin Roosevelt in World War II and the Depression was in there for four terms in a row. And after that, Congress passed a law that said, we're going to have a two-term limit.
But otherwise, it was kind of an unspoken rule that
exactly.
It was two terms?
Yeah.
Oh,
and
okay.
Washington really set the tone, set the precedent for many, many mm-hmm. things that the president, mm-hmm. you know, presidents are responsible for these days.
So John Adams then was elected.
Yeah, he runs as the vice president.
Was he ever in the military like
no.
Washington? Okay.
No, John Adams was a lawyer, a very good lawyer, and he helped. He's one of what we call the founding fathers. Our first presidents, first six of them, all of them were from Virginia except for Adams and Adams, and they were from Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. So he was an attorney.
So let's get to the politics of the party.
Yeah. Okay, so this is good. You know, right now we're looking at these different candidates, and they're starting, and obviously, well, I don't know for sure if Donald Trump has picked his, you know, running mate. We're making an assumption. You pick somebody that's going to be on your team and work with you, and a lot of times you pick somebody that's going to attract votes from a different part of the country. Well, in the time we're talking about, in the early 1800s, if you got to be the most votes or, you know, the most electoral votes, you became president. If you got the second most electoral votes, you became vice president.
Oh.
So you would have to be your running mate. Your opponent would be, you know, end up being your vice president. And they might have different policies. Of course, the vice president doesn't really have a lot of power. It's a stepping stone to the presidency. But and I don't know how often they thought about presidents dying at that time. It's really Lincoln. It's the first time that's going to happen. So Jefferson becomes the vice president. And they don't really, they're not on the same page. And then we get what were called, I mean, there were political parties in Britain for a long time. But Adams was a Federalist who believed in a strong central government. Hamilton was a Federalist who believed in a strong central government and a strong financial system. Jefferson was a Republican. And again, the names are just words that we come up with. You know, it's not to do with the Republicans today. And he just believed in less weaker government, less obtrusive government. And then all of a sudden, there's party politics that are going on. And Washington, in his speech as he was done being president, warned against, you know, if we get into politics and different parties, it's going to hurt our country because we're just going to keep bickering. And again, nothing ever changes. You know, and we think that there's a big issue now, and there is, in my opinion, but really, it's nothing new. When Lincoln was around, when Andrew Jackson was around, same kind of mudslinging, same kind of politics were going on. It's the same.
We just
thing.
Hear about it more because of the news.
Well, and that's right. And we're just inundated not only with the news, but the social media. It's in our faces all the time. And so, you know, we just seem to feel it more. But still, it's important thing that we understand that we need to work together.
Do you think when the Revolutionary War was going on in the colony area that the states, like you mentioned, Florida, that neck of the woods, that part of our what is now our country, do you think they had any idea there was fighting up there, or was it so separate?
No, I think that people knew about it. You know, Florida was Spanish, but Spain was a world power at that time, too. They weren't nearly as strong as they had been, but they knew what was going on. The French, too. You know, after the war, the French and Indian War, France is a major power in Europe, and Napoleon was coming into power kind of at the end of our revolution. Well, the French revolutions is what happened with that. But I think there was an awareness. Now, an interesting thing is as a guy that likes history, there's a perspective. And one time a student brought in many years ago a history book, like an eighth grade history book from Britain, from England. Like his mom, his grandma, somebody had come from England and then brought this book. So I'm reading it. It was not, you know, a college book. It was just like an eighth grade history book for the history of England. And we probably had a half page, maybe a full page for the American Revolution. And I don't think they even mentioned the War of 1812 in there at all. So, you know, in their history, I'm not saying this is unimportant. It just wasn't as in the big picture.
And yet they helped birth the greatest country on earth.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny? And it's one paragraph.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's perspective.
It is.
You know, I mean, Britain has a long history.
Yes. Well, this was great perspective. We really appreciated it. Thank you so much for giving a little bit of history about the 4th of July, which we celebrate with fireworks, and that's from?
Well, and the Chinese came up with fireworks in the, 800 A.D. It goes way, way back. But, you know, we fired cannon during the American Revolution. They, on the Independence Day, they would shoot cannons. They would give extra, you know, glasses of rum to the soldiers, do different celebrations. We pretty much celebrate it the same way, you know, with fireworks and
extra glasses.
Yeah, exactly. But let me mention really quick, I'm going to do two things on Independence Day. I'm going to first drive out to Excelsior. There's a Revolutionary War group is doing a demonstration for a town festival. And then it goes till noon. And then in Stillwater, I'm in a Civil War group that does artillery, and we're going to shoot cannons all day long until the fireworks. So I'll be in a wool uniform all day. But what I used to do for many years at Fort Snelling, they have a big Independence Day. There's a big parade of soldiers. And they go around in their dress uniforms with the flag, and they play Yankee Doodle and other, you know, fife and drums. There's a really good fife and drum band there. So lots of cool things to do besides just sit in your yard and barbecue.
I agree. Well, let's get out and celebrate. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
Mr. Spencer Johnson, retired teacher and a historian. And if you did not learn something new about the 4th of July, you need to listen to this interview again. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You are listening to another edition of Community in Depth on AM 1460 and FM 97.7 KDWA in Hastings.